Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, we're happy to have with us our guest, Colin McCann, author of Letters to a Young Writer, Some Practical and Philosophical Advice, published earlier this month by Random House. Colm is the award-winning, internationally best-selling author of Let the Great World Spin, Zoli, Dancer, This Side of Brightness, and Song Dogs. He teaches at the MFA program at Hunter College. Letters is just that, a series of missives to an imaginary young writer who may be confused, excited, forlorn, unsure, but she knows she wants to write and nothing can stop her. If a dilettante, a scribbler like me, picks up this book, I will gain enormous knowledge and write better. But in order to take the fullest and really only advantage of this book, you must be a writer. That is, you wake up in the morning and you have to write. Letters pushes you, guides you, goads you, and most oftentimes inspires you. And notwithstanding Rilke's saying that nobody can advise you and help you, nobody, there is advice here, and there is guidance. There's a certain zen-like quality to the book, a kind of like, this may not work, and it may not make you a better writer, but try doing it anyway. Kind of like meditation, you know, nothing happens. Without meandering too much, as I want to do, let's just say this. It's a good book for a young writer to carry around, to underline, to dog-ear, to Google the epigraphs at the head of each chapter, to read while writing, to write while reading. And with that, welcome, Colm, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
So as we were saying right before the broadcast, why do you think it's necessary or beneficial to even worry about young writers, let alone devote a whole series of letters to them?
Well, I've been teaching now for about 30 years. I first started out teaching when I worked with juvenile delinquents at a ranch in Texas when I was passing through on an epic journey on a bicycle. And I ended up teaching high school to kids who were from broken families and broken backgrounds. I was possibly teaching them to be more delinquent than they already were, but I loved it. And then after that, I went to Japan, where I taught Japanese students English as a second language, and then went back to Ireland, and then came back to New York, where I taught English as a second language again, and then fell into teaching as a novelist. So writing and teaching at the same time. So I love teaching, and I like the idea of keeping myself sort of invigorated by being in touch with these young writers, but also knowing that I'd like to be able to clop off or lop off a little bit of time on their learning curve with a stray word here and there. But my philosophy is that I really, honestly can't teach anyone how to write unless they have a real fire and a real desire inside them.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at in the introduction. How did you decide to use, which is a big part of the book, to use epigraphs at the beginning of each chapter, and how did you go about choosing them? Because they add tremendously to the work.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, this whole project was sort of accidental. You know, last year on Facebook, I decided that I was going to have a Facebook presence. I'm a terrible Luddite. I don't know anything about technology. But my publisher said, you know, you should have like maybe a social media presence. I said, I hate that crap. I don't want to know like somebody was eating a peach, you know, or you know this, that, or other thing that you see on a lot of people's Facebook. It all seems so ruinously trivial. And then I thought, okay, well, I'll try and say something. And I thought, okay, what I'll do is I'll write a letter to a young writer every week with a bit of advice. And I thought that lots of people would get on with the Facebook. As it turned out, no one gave a tuppenny bit. Like a couple of new people every week. So I was writing about first lines, last lines, punctuation, little essays on empathy, you know, all the sort of stuff. And then I remembered a piece of advice that I gave one of my students when he was misbehaving, at a party in New York, and I told him, don't be a d-. And guess what? Suddenly, I wrote the essay, don't be a d-, and that one went viral. Go figure. That's the sort of world that we live in. But really what I was saying is, you know, you don't have to live up to the romantic illusions of being a writer. You don't have to, you know, insult people. You know, behave yourself. Think, not behave yourself too well. I don't advocate, you know, an empty liquor cabinet. I don't advocate a clean life necessarily. But be good to people. Be kind to people. Be honest with people.
Well, when you do these epigraphs, and when I suggested in the outset that it was kind of like almost meditative, when you take a quote from Somerset Maugham that there are three rules for writing a novel, unfortunately no one knows what they are.
Yeah.
And you go off on that. What is that saying? Because, you know, you do it two ways. You say, there really isn't anything I can tell you, but here, I'm telling you this instead.
Right. Well, you know, so I was writing these every week, and then when it finally came back to me to put them together in a book, I remembered all the little aphorisms that I'd collected down through the years, and I'm a bit of a quote monger. I really like quoting people, so it seemed natural to me to find quotes from, say, you know, Peter Carey, Taya Albrecht, Somerset Maugham, you know, Edward Abbey, Annie Dillard, all these, you know, all these great writers who I love and admire, to add their voice to my voice, because it seems to me, and one of the things I say in the book is that, you know, as writers we get our voice from the voices of others. We are a sort of collision. We are an accumulation of all those different voices coming together. And so for me, it was also saying that there are lots of ways to think about the art and the craft of writing, and lots of people have said very, very interesting things which have informed me down through the years, and to sort of to extend it, you know, like this program does, extend it into a community of artists and writers who are thinking about the power of what we do or don't do.
It's interesting because you do claim him as your own, but even besides that, you have one page chapter that just says, read Joyce.
Yeah.
And you do make several references to Joyce, and one of the aphorisms is by Joyce about the fact that he has the words, he's just trying to find the right order to put them in.
Right.
And then you talk about the fact that Tom Joad is real, Leopold Bloom is real, Jay Gatsby is real. What do you mean by that? For somebody who's a layperson or someone like me who tries to write.
Yeah.
What does it mean? Are these, how real is real? What does that actually mean?
That's a great question. I mean, one of the things that's very much on my mind, and I think it's probably on the culture's mind right now, is what is real and what is invented? When we have these notions of, you know, fake news and facts that are manipulated, and you know, people doing these mercenary things with facts and using them in the wrong ways. What's real and what's imagined? Well, it strikes me that the imagined, as Clifford Geertz, the sociologist, says, the imagined is real and the real is imagined. What I mean by that is that when you talk about the real being imagined, we can talk about people manipulating news. And so the reality of the world becomes the part of their imagination, and that's about lies. The idea that the imagined is real is a little bit more difficult. How does, you know, the imagined become something solid and true in the world? Well, when I think about the Great Depression, my history take on the Great Depression is filtered through the book The Grapes of Wrath, and it strikes me that the character in that, Tom Joad, is the way that I negotiate the reality of the Great Depression. And he, as a character, is very real in my perception and my approach to the world. The same thing with Leopold Bloom. I mean, Leopold Bloom is as real to me as the 7 billion people in this world that I haven't yet met. And I think that this is the true power of imaginative literature, that you can, as a writer, create what isn't yet there. And in doing so, you can sort of shift the world sideways a little, as, say, the Grapes of Wrath has done, as important works of literature coming from the imagination, coming from the supposed dust of the imagination, they can actually rock the world in certain ways. And to me, this is inspirational. This is one of the reasons why I want to write and why I want to create and why I want to read, frankly.
You know, the obverse of that is also true. Like, if you read the Nighttown episode of Ulysses, you realize that he was just out at a bar writing down things people were saying. And I've, again, frustratingly for me, I've gone to bars and sat there and drunk and had my notebook, like you suggested all writers carry around with them all the time.
Right.
And I wrote down everything everybody said. The frustrating part is when I got back, I realized this is better than anything I could ever write.
Well, but that's kind of wonderful, because you made the decision that this is an artistic thing. You have decided that these voices that are there in the real world can be put together in an imaginative way that nobody else has done. I mean, I really love the tension between fiction and nonfiction. In fact, I don't even like the word fiction anymore. I rather talk about stories and storytelling, because I think that the way we as writers have to now approach the world is that reality, and I use this word as sparingly as possible and with as great irony as possible too, reality trumps invention. and you know, I can't imagine, you know, having been able to write a novel about what is going on politically in this country right now. So the writer is sort of confronted with reality, and she or he has to make some sort of imaginative sense and beauty out of it, or else we are well and truly, I was going to use a bad word, but I won't because we're on the radio, we're well and truly doomed.
I was just going to use the word doom, and the question is, are we well and truly doomed? I saw this panel discussion with comedians, and they were complaining because they no longer have any material, because just like Saturday Night Live, it's almost impossible now to satirize, because what's happening is so... I wake up in the morning, and the first thing I do is I think everything is fine, and then I think, no, Donald J. Trump is president of the United States.
That's right.
And then it goes downward from there. I think it's actually affected my health. But
are you not the only one? I'm the same. You know, my 13-year-old boy woke up and like just a couple of weeks ago, and just the very first thing he said to me in the morning was like, "So what fresh atrocity does Trump have for us this morning, Dad?" You know.
And the problem is, you become so callous that when you read that Ivanka has her secret service clearance and is still selling and is worth $750 million, you begin to become insulated from it, and that's what's really scary.
But so it won't take away our stories. It will not take away our stories. It will not take away the necessity that we have to tell one another that we are still valuable. It will not take away the necessity that we have to communicate something that happened to us in the world. Nothing will take away our stories, and nothing will ever really. I believe in the power of literature. I am completely committed to the idea that no matter what happens around us, we still have literature and we still have the power of storytelling to work against it. And stories can change things. They really can change things. I would love for your listeners to go to the New York Magazine of December in 2016, when the organization of which I am president, Narrative 4, that co-founded with Lisa Consiglio, we did a story exchange between people of wildly different political backgrounds in relation to the notion of gun awareness. And these people, instead of like getting on their high horse and saying the Second Amendment this and my trauma was this, and they told one another stories about their lives, and it is truly sort of amazing that there was political change that came out of that meeting, but there was also on a very deep level, people were greatly affected by the fact that they could tell a story, but even better, that their story would be listened to at the same time. So I know that's kind of a clarion call, and I sound like I'm on my high horse, and I don't want to be, but I do think that this stuff matters.
I was talking today to someone about this interview, and I quoted the aphorism by Truman Capote about how he waits for the music of the words. And as soon as I said that, the woman said, "Can I read that book when you're done with it?" And that goes to something somewhat like what you're saying, is that what is that music? And if we're going back to the young writer who we should be talking about, what's the music he or she is listening for?
Yeah, well, it's a music of chance. It's a music of you know, that finds something new to say. It's a music that's never been done before. It's all forms of music, whether it be John Cage, whether it be Sting, whether it be the Counting Crows or Dave Gray or whoever it happens to be. There's so many different forms of music out there. In fact, when you think about it, there really are 7 billion forms of music to be engaged in, because everyone has their own particular music. The job of the young writer is to make sense of the real jangle of notes that are going on, because things are pretty friggin' discordant right now. And you sort of gather in those notes, not to make them beautiful, not necessarily to make them beautiful, but gather in those notes to make a certain amount of sense of them. If we can do that, then we will be on the road to some sort of meaning. But, you know, writers have been in this position for centuries, and they have to keep reacting to the times that are in it. And all these people who are doom and gloom and, oh, the novel is dead and all that sort of stuff, frankly, they're talking through their arses. I mean, the story will never, ever, ever, the need for story will never disappear. We as writers have to find a way to put it together so that others will listen to us properly. That's our job.
When I was researching it, I was thinking about Let the Great World Spin, and then I read the Faulkner aphorism, which is that the idea of the author is to arrest motion so that you can come back 100 years later and it moves again. And I realized you did that in Let the Great World Spin, but you did it almost instantaneously. You created in 1979... a world that could be looked at in 2017 without even utilizing the event that, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's nice of you to say. I mean, yeah, Philippe Petit, it was actually 74, but...
74, sorry.
But, the job of the writer is to find that moment and present it to people, not to be didactic about it, but so that they can walk inside it, so that in a certain way, they can, if you write it well enough, they will be that tightrope walker who walks up to the very top of the World Trade Center towers and goes out into the middle of the wire. The beauty of writing is that it can do those things and suggest those things without us having to literally, in reality, experience them. And in this way, I think this is really interesting. I've been thinking a lot about this recently. Like, proper engaged writing is a form of narrative nonviolence. And in fact, maybe even a form of proper civil disobedience. The fact that we read and we write, we become someone else. Because the way that it's nonviolent is that it might inflict some sort of wound, but you don't have the physical scar. But it also has the ability, and this, I don't want to be corny about it, because I do not want the trumpets or the violins to come out. It's not my job as a writer, but it does also have the ability to heal some things.
But it's like, you know, you sound so optimistic, and I'm like naturally fatalistic, and the concept of the pen being mightier than the sword right now seems very difficult.
It
seems like a very difficult thing, and maybe that's why, another reason why this book is at an opportune time.
Yeah, well, you know, the way I think about it is, like, every person who's down about what's going on right now, every person who's cynical about what's going on right now, every person who is just in a really dark corner, guess what? They're absolutely right. They are 100% right. But my take on it is, so what? Big deal. There's not any great revelation that the world is dark. There's not any great revelation that we're really, you know, struggling right now. The really proper revelation is somehow to get beyond it, you know? And I would be prepared to go toe-to-toe in a scrap with any cynic out there. And I think I could out-cynic them with their cynicism. Because I think that's the way I should be. And then at the end of it, I just say, okay, fair enough. But that's what else can we do? You know, how do you actually, you know, get over the wall? Because there's no point in being that, like, smartass in the corner of the party complaining about everything. Because, you know, in the end, nobody was going to want to dance with you.
No, that's what I do. You know, it's funny when you, I remember all of the aphorisms, and it really does tie the book together. But Borges, when he says, an axis of innumerable relationships, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Is you're creating that. And when I think back to, like, even like the Library of Babel or the library, that'll stay with me forever, and it's created so many different relationships in my mind and with other people.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what you're advocating, and I guess that's what he's advocating.
Well, Borges, with the Aleph, and, you know, what Borges was advocating was, you know, a paradise that is a library. What Borges was saying is that we're all part of this story. And even someone like Beckett, who's traditionally seen to be, you know, the grand pessimist, wasn't really, at the end, pessimistic at all. He talked on a personal level in his letters, and also in one of his plays, he talked about the vivifying air of failure and the fire that one gets with age and things like that. And frankly, if you look at every single Nobel-winning speech about literature for the past, I don't know how many years it is, 80 years, 90 years, more, I don't know, every single one of them, maybe bar one or two, has a note of incredible optimism about the fact that, you know, we have literature in order to guide us away from the dark. We have stories in order to guide us away from, you know, the absolute despair, because there'd be no reason to go on. You know, again, Beckett, can't go on, must go on. That's pretty optimistic to me.
And also, you quote him again in your chapter, no matter, try again, fail better.
Yeah, my students are so sick of me saying
that. I can imagine.
They are so sick of me. It's like, oh, Jesus, McCann, shut up. But I love it. I mean, it's really true. It's like, unless you're trying unless you're inviting failure to your door, you're not doing anything as far as I'm concerned.
It might be the best piece of advice in the entire book.
Yeah. Take it all the way back to Beckett.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the one thing that struck me about the book was that you and then the aphorism by the quote from Stephen King, put down plot, but you minimize it.
Yeah.
And you talk about, again, going back to Ulysses, how here's a book that really, apparently, and the key word is apparently, has no plot at all.
Right.
It's just one day, Bloomsday, and that's it.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you came to that in your formative years as a writer, and also thought that it was so important to tell your prospective writers.
Yeah, well, I say in the book that plot is juvenile, and people are shocked by me saying that, but what I mean by that is that, you know, plot is subservient to character. Character is so much more important than plot. In fact, character is so much more important than intellect in so many ways. And then it goes back again to language. Language is what creates these characters on the page, so that the ultimate thing is not what happens, but how it happens. And so you can have a book in which, like Ulysses, in which apparently nothing happens, but actually the whole human heart gets mapped out. It is a vast, you know, compendium of human experience right there. And really, it's just about a man, a cuckolded man who walks around Dublin for 24 hours. But in all of that, it's so much actually happened. I mean, and let me say here that you know, even though I seem to be down on plot, I understand that things have to happen in a book. They do. They absolutely have to happen. But I don't think we should put as much emphasis on it as a lot of, say, writing programs seem to want to do. What it really comes down to, in the end, is language.
How come stately, plump Buck Mulligan sounds so good?
Isn't that great?
How come? Why does it sound so good?
Because it's got that onomatopoeia. I mean, it's like the inscape of language, which is what you know, Jared Manley Hopkins talked about. You know, if you read a Jared Manley Hopkins poem, you know that Joyce was reading a poet like him. It's like, you know, the poem by Hopkins is, you know, Kingdom of Daylight's Dauphin, Dappled Dawn, Drawn Falcon, in the riding of his rolling level, underneath them steady air. I mean, suddenly, when you read those lines, you are a falcon, you're a wind hover. And it's the collision of words, it's the music of language. It's how these things are put together in unusual and usual combinations to make us see things.
And you even use So Much Depends on a Red Wheelbarrow as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I do. I mean, but that's the function. Like, the good literature doesn't tell us anything, but it allows us more or less everything. And there's a big difference between telling and allowing. The good stuff is not interested in telling us how to feel or how to be.
Well, it's like the one, I guess it was, I don't know if I'm right now, about Raymond Carver saying it's good at the end of a short story for both the writer and the reader to pause for a moment.
Oh, yeah.
And I've always thought that. I think that's very important as well.
Yeah. I mean, if often one of the things that you should do with your last line is you should get rid of your last line.
Huh.
Because it's already there. You know, don't tell people too much. Allow them to feel. We all... You know, you have to trust your reader as well, and that's something that I do. I trust my reader, and I'm not playing to the gallery when I say that my readers are always much more intelligent than I am, because they discover things about a book that I hadn't seen before. And often, to be honest with you, I don't even know why I'm writing a book. It's just there. It's compulsive. It's obsessive.
And that's who you're writing to. That's who these letters are for.
Yeah, I'm writing to the young, to the young obsessive. But what's interesting is who is young. You know,
yeah.
I do a little essay about that in the book. It's like, well, a young writer can be 64 years old. You know?
That's how old I am.
Are you 64?
Yep.
All right. Well, see, Frank McCourt was 64 when he was working on Angela's Ashes. So there's always time.
I wrote today. You're right. I can write character, I can write exposition, narrative. I don't have a story.
Huh, but the story comes out of character. The story emerges. Like, you create the character, and the character will tell you what it is that he wants to have happen to him.
Okay, today this guy wanted to be able to see again.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, that's a story in itself.
Okay. I think I think according to your publicist, I've kept you well past your appointed time now.
That's
Well, as long as you don't mind.
No, I'm cool. Okay.
I was really happy to see that Gary Steingart has been on the show, and he's kind of a pain in the ass, but he's really funny.
He's so funny.
He is a pain in the ass, though. But how did you get him to blurb your chapter on blurbing?
I just think, Gary's really funny. Gary's really generous. Gary is a blurb whore, and he is top of the list. He is number one in the brothel of blurbdom. I'm close to number two, because I have to stop it recently. But I just like when people ask me for a blurb, I really want to try and help them out. But it takes like 2 days to read a book, you know, and then you got to blurb it. And like now my postman hates me. Because I get like 24, 25 books a week, and people asking for blurbs, and I can't do it anymore. But so Gary is more generous than anybody.
But he doesn't read them.
He what?
He doesn't read them.
I think he skims them and scans them, and yeah, sometimes he blurbs them without reading them. That has to be that's true. But I just thought it'd be very funny if Gary would blurb my chapter on blurbing, which is what he did. So I sent him the chapter, and he sent me a blurb for the blurb chapter. So I just thought, yeah, okay, there we go. The world comes full circle.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it, and I really enjoy talking to you about this book. And I own an independent bookstore, so come April 4th, it's already on our table.
Thank you.
But
where's the store?
The store is just outside of Philadelphia, like I said, about 30 minutes from where you are right now at the Lowe's Hotel.
Right.
And, yeah, if you ever get a chance to come by, that would be great. I'll try and figure out how I could get
you
there.
You're in Chester, right?
Yeah, I'm in Chester County.
I went through Chester on my bicycle years ago.
Really? When you were doing your big trip?
Yeah, Chester, PA. Isn't there a Dublin near you as well?
Yeah, there is.
Yeah. No, I went through Chester. There was a newspaper office there that I did some work at.
That's right where I am right now.
You're kidding me.
Yep, it's a Daily Local, yep.
Yeah. And there's a little diner just down the road.
Yep. The diner's torn down, sorry.
Oh, it is?
Yep.
Oh, man, I went through there literally in 1986 on a bicycle.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I wish I wish I had an hour or two. I'd hop down and see you.
Yeah.
One of these days.
Yeah, one of these days. Maybe when this comes out in paperback or your next novel, I would love to set something up. And it's hard for me to do sometimes, but we just got voted best independent bookstore in the state of Pennsylvania, so
Perfect.
Now we're doing really well.
All right.
I'm real happy about that. So, but thank you so much, and thank you for all the work that you've done. You've made, you know, so many...
Oh, you're very kind.
Okay.
You're so kind. Thank you so much. And, hello to all the young writers.
Okay.
All right, cheers.
Cheers. We were talking with Colin McCann about his new book, Letters to a Young Writer, Some Practical and Philosophical Advice. It was just published early last month, by Random House. And he's a great guy and a great conversationalist, and it was a pleasure talking to him. And I'm really glad that he wrote this, because if you are a young writer and you really are up against the wall and you don't know what to do, this is the perfect book to carry around with you, like I said, to dog ear, to line through, to rip a page out of. It's well worth it, because if you're ever in a situation where you're hopeless and lost and don't know what to do, you can sweep through the book and find something that will salvage your plan to become the great American novelist. In any event, that was fun. I'm exhausted, but that was fun. Coming up is Leanda Lynn Hauptman, who's going to be discussing her fascinating new novel, Mozart's Starling, which is about the starling that inspired Mozart to write some of his music. And I'm really looking forward to that. In any event, we have tons of new authors. Rebecca's got a whole stable of them in line to be interviewed. I also said that Real Simple Magazine just voted our bookstore the best bookstore in Pennsylvania. Things are going great there. I wish you would come by and see us. It's Wellington Square Bookshop on Route 100, just off the turnpike in Eagleview Town Center, where there are also a whole slew of new restaurants, Bella Vista, Al Pastor, Suburban, Nudie's, Rita's, Brickside. It's like a whole restaurant row, like a little Westchester. So come down and see us, and come back and listen to us next week here on The Avid Reader.